Jack, so far it would seem that in developing this idea of doing ethics, it's largely been what might be called bioethics. The examples have been abortion and euthanasia and so on. Do the same principles, on the same bases that you've developed, the same models, do they apply to all the other areas of human behavior?
Yes, and I think it's difficult actually to separate bioethics from the larger field of moral concern. It's just that bioethics has come to be a term applied specifically to the kinds of things we used to refer to as medical ethics. Mm-hmm. Bioethics gives a little more room for allowing, for example, for genetic engineering problems and experimental protocols. And
well, you haven't touched on those.
No, we haven't. But before I do that, I'd like to expand a little bit on something I was talking about last night when we were talking about abortion. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that one of my reasons for valuing the fetus had to do with the protection of my sensitivities because of what the fetus means in terms of human life. And we observe that if we define value of the fetus along with the kinds of ways we define value of the self for a more mature person, that the fetus gains its value because of its potential for becoming a self. But it also gains its value from its current meaning in a symbolic sense. Let me describe that just a little bit. Man is sometimes defined, as you know, as Homo sapiens, which refers to his intelligence, his intellect, and also Homo faber, which refers to his tool-using capacity. One fabricates things. But there's a third term that is not commonly used, but is probably the basis for both of these other definitions. That is, man is Homo symbolicus. Man is a symbol user. Now, he doesn't have a corner on that market totally. You know, there are certain kinds of symbolic actions that actuate animal behavior as well. But man's use of symbols is so much a part of his existence and his meaning in life that it's almost as though he has a corner on the market. A symbol being defined now as an entity that gains its value, or at least part of its value, from its pointing function. It refers to something else. It stands for the thing to which it refers. Now, that may be a kind of a general definition of symbol, but I think that it's applicable to the wide variety of entities that can become symbolic. For example, language is loaded with all kinds of symbol. That is, I make sounds, and if you're in on the symbols, you don't hear the sounds so much as you hear the ideas that are being conveyed.
You remember the old teacher we had together who said reading is bringing meaning to two words as symbols.
That's right. I mean, that's
we were upset in his classes.
And it is the basis for intellection, basis even for communication, because probably after you once get your language structure, all communication, or all thought is verbal thought. Mm-hmm. You think in words. When you learn a new language, you know you have come to master that language when you start thinking in that language. Mm-hmm. We think, we choose, we interact, and we intercommunicate with symbols, and it's a very basic part of being human. Religious people have always known this. Mm-hmm. This is the reason why, at least in some traditions, symbols play such an important role. Mm-hmm. I saw a book on architecture recently that described the symbols that this architect was building into Roman Catholic churches. Mm-hmm. The position of the altar, the position of the seats and the furniture, mm-hmm. the stained glass windows, and all the rest of this had a kind of a meaning. Mm-hmm. Our basic human interactions, for example, in business, are largely symbolic. I have here someplace a piece of paper, the intrinsic value of which it's really pretty minor.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe 2 or 3 cents. This is valuable paper. It's more like cloth than it is like paper. And but its chief value is for what it stands for. Mm-hmm. This stands for a certain amount of time spent in human labor. But that's probably the ultimate denominator for it. When $1 isn't going to buy very much of it today. But if you take the same piece of paper, which is worth 2 or 3 cents, instead of just a one, you added 5 zeros after that one. Now, you wouldn't add much value to the paper. In fact, it's really not very valuable as paper. Mm-hmm. In the mountains of Utah a few years ago, some hunters were out deer hunting, and a sudden snow came, an early snow in the fall. And they were caught without adequate clothing, no snowshoes or anything. They were snowed in with snow clear up to their chests. And they struggled to get out of the snow, and eventually became exhausted and had to stop. And they tramped down a place in the snow to give them a little room, and they found them there several days later, frozen to death. But in the center of that tramped down area were a little pile of ashes. And as they sifted through the ashes, there were little bits of green paper that showed up in the ashes. They tried to build a fire out of it, and it wasn't even very good fire paper. It was not very valuable as paper, although I suspect if you could buy a ream of this, if it were legal to do so, it might cost you $75 or $100 for a ream, see. But if you put those five zeros afterwards, you haven't changed the intrinsic value of the paper, but you have enormously inflated the symbolic value of it.
Mm-hmm.
See, you've shifted a little ink around as far as the paper is concerned, but the symbolic value is enormous. And people, you know, would kill for a lot less than that. And if you had two or three of those in your pocket, you'd better be riding in a Brinks armored truck or have a private army. Well, symbols have to do with this kind of meaning. Now,
it also symbolizes the full faith and credit of the United States
government. That's correct.
Too.
That's correct. And there are symbolic actions that are like this. I was in Beirut before Lebanon threw itself apart in this horrible war that's gone on for so long. And it was largely a paper economy. It was an open market,
mm-hmm.
and had the second highest living standard in the Middle East, second only to Israel. It was an open market, and they were selling gold and all kinds of interesting things, but they were largely paper transactions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd sign your name to a piece of paper, mm-hmm. and enormous amounts of wealth could be shifted by that. I could take a piece of paper, and on this make a few scribbles, not many, and sign this, mm-hmm. properly witnessed. I could symbolically transfer my total life savings to you.
Accepted, trusted.
That's right. This would hold up in court if they were properly witnessed, and could be sure that I...
There had to be agreement, then, as to the meaning of the symbol.
That's correct. So the symbol has to communicate. But symbols not only communicate, they create attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
And that piece of paper on which I sign my name, the attitude toward my wealth would shift now from mine to you. Mm-hmm. It now becomes yours and not mine. Or if you were to sign something for me, it's no longer yours, but mm-hmm. is mine. The attitude toward it changes. And that, of course, is part of what's involved in religious symbols. The symbolic things we do, like saying prayers.
Mm-hmm.
In essence, prayer is a kind of a life. It's a relationship that is not just a formula mm-hmm. you speak. But the prayers we say have symbolic amplification or reinforcement of that quality of life, which is communion with God.
Mm-hmm.
When Christ prays all night long, probably he's thinking most of the time
mm-hmm.
and not saying formulas. But we say a little formula before a meal because it conditions our attitudes toward God's gift of the food.
Mm-hmm.
And people who understand this would tend to routinely use these symbols not as ways of influencing God or whatever reasons we would be saying prayers,
mm-hmm.
but recognizing that this is how we keep our religious experience with God intact, symbolically reinforcing it. Because attitudes can be conditioned mm-hmm. by how we treat symbols. Now that has some significance to ethics, because while in fact, for example, the fetus or embryo
mm-hmm.
is not functionally a self, it means self because of what it can become, and has the implications and creates the attitudes. An individual to treat that symbolic self as though it were nothing or a tumor,
mm-hmm.
you see, are conditioning their attitudes toward mm-hmm. that which will one day be a baby. If you were to treat all fetuses as though they were objects,
mm-hmm.
you would lose the capacity that those 9 months are to create in you to have mm-hmm. open arms ready when this infant joins the human family outside of the uterus. Now this 9 months is a part of the conditioning of the attitudes that make mm-hmm. parenting and family significant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of what I think is being lost in a society in which many people tend to look upon reproduction in thing terms rather than meaning terms. It's the same thing for the patient I described to you the other night who'd had his stroke and had suffered brain death in the hospital. The family wouldn't let me shut off the ventilator because they saw the monitor still working. Mm-hmm. He was on this ventilator and thus his central organs were still functional. And they wouldn't let me shut it off because that meant alive to them. See, this beating monitor, beating heart, symbolized that this patient was still alive. To me, the flat brain waves symbolized that he was dead. And we had to find agreement on our symbols so he'd have the same meaning, so I could now sign on the chart, send for the mortician. So we could do the things that are appropriate to a corpse because the individual had come to mean corpse.
Okay, I compare that with a phrase you coined the other day, tissue issue.
Yes.
That tissue might be symbolic of something significant.
That's correct. But this has implications in a number of areas. For example, I've had the medical students ask me on occasion, students who've had pets and like animals and so on, and come to a physiology class where a group of four students may be working around a table on a rabbit, a live rabbit, you understand, investigating physiologic responses to certain medications and whatever on this rabbit. But some of them don't like this. They say, now, why should we do this? Because, indeed, what's being done to this rabbit is not novel information that we're gaining. I mean, this has all been done before by hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. Or it could be done with a video camera and just project it on a screen. We could all watch it there. But here are all these students working around this rabbit. They're making a real point. Because how you treat animals can also condition your attitudes toward other living things, including human beings. St. Francis of Assisi once said, show me someone who's callous in his treatment of animals, and I will show you a man who's cruel to humans. There's a kind of a symbolic reinforcement of an attitude that carries over. And it has some implications in terms of animal experimentation. Now, I think that it's appropriate for those students to learn how to give injections to rabbits before they start giving injections to people, and also learning how to control their feelings in a situation where they may be under a certain amount of emotional stress because of a contact with a live form, because someday in an emergency room that may have conditioned them a bit for it. But it is also important that as they do this, they retain their sensitivities toward this living form. And I'll tell you that I think this is the reason why in the Old Testament God insisted that the Israelites, when they ate the flesh of animals, they didn't partake of the blood. The blood symbolized something. This is the life. And they must know that this is not a casual thing. You don't take the life of the animal. You think of all the animals that were sacrificed in the sacrificial system. Enormous numbers of animals. Blood all over the place, you see. But they had to keep reminding themselves that there was a sacrament involved here. This was a sacred thing. You don't take life casually. The blood stands for the life, symbolizes it, and therefore creates an attitude toward the act. Well, animal experimentation is a part of this, and I have tried to teach my students, yes, you must do this as a part of your becoming conditioned to know how to operate in an operating room and how to deal with patients in emergency rooms and so on. But don't ever let it become common. When I first came to my medical school, it was an anatomy class. Samuel Crookes was the teacher. Very fascinating person. And his first lecture, he said to us, he's your medical students, I want you to remember that what you're doing is a sacred thing. And you must bring a proper respect and decorum to your cutting up these cadavers in the anatomy laboratory. And he who would brook no levity or games playing around in that process, you have a great privilege of investigating God's creation here. Now show proper respect. This is a lecture I never quite forgot.
In the case of Baby Faye, hasn't Dr. Bailey been at pains to express that he was not careless about the removal of the heart from the baboon?
That's correct.
And that was very appropriate that he do
that's
so.
That's correct. And people who are worried about animal rights, lest animals are treated cruelly, also have a point. And animal experimentation, which must be done, otherwise you're going to have to do that experimentation on humans, because some of these things you cannot learn without that kind of effort. They must also bring to their experimentation the kind of protection against pain and anxiety to those animals that you would extend to a human being. Well, that's a reach back into the past. Now, talking about the family may be a way of getting at another problem that I think we've got to take a look at that has contemporary interest raised at a significant level, which is not usually considered to be bioethics as such. It has to do with what in the old days was considered to be sinful behavior and deviant, in which today, by large numbers of people, is being advocated as a simple alternative way of relating. This is a homosexual. Homosexuality is a very complex matter. We don't know all of the etiology or cause of homosexuality as yet. There's an increasing body of evidence that suggests that a person who finds himself attracted to the same sex doesn't choose to do this as much as it is imposed upon him. In other words, he may discover his tendency rather than having chosen to function this way.
Is that opinion growing? Because I hear people taking the other views.
No, it's a growing opinion. It's one that homosexuals like to resist because that means that they're some way deviant or abnormal. Whereas if they had chosen it, then you see it becomes an alternative lifestyle for which they had volition and they prefer that kind of life. But there are increasing studies that suggest this. One of these, of some interest, a few years ago at Villanova University, Dr. Ingeborg Ward took rats, pregnant rats, and placed them in plexiglass tubes, just crammed them in, and of course the plexiglass was transparent. And rats that are nocturnal animals, when exposed to lights, are frightened, and they'd take these rats that were plunged into these plexiglass tubes, then expose them to strobe lights and other flashing lights that frighten them dreadfully over a period of time, and then release them. And they discovered that a significant number of these offspring of these rats were homosexual rats. They behaved in a certain kind of way. They've come to identify with homosexual behavior on the part of
rats.
They
were mature rats?
These are infant rats. As they mature, so they start having sexual interest, they apparently had become sexually oriented to the same sex, and thus homosexual rats. Now, that experiment has been repeated, and the body of opinion that seems to be developing, at least in the medical world, is that one has to say that something happens along the way to the developing fetus. And Ingeborg Ward has described it this way. She said that under stress, the stress hormones, ACTH, interfere with the other kinds of hormones, testosterone or androstenedione, the androstenedione, and competes with this as it hits certain receptor sites. And the androstenedione takes over, and the sexual orientation is influenced by this. Now, it takes later experience, apparently, to take that orientation and actually imprint it as a homosexual kind of drive, so that there's usually a combination of what has happened during that interuterine period and what takes place later as experience, particularly during the period of puberty. Well, now, if this is the case, Christians are faced with a very interesting problem. That is, you've got a Bible that in both Testaments strongly opposes homosexual behavior. And in the Old Testament, as you recall, the penalty for this was death. And the New Testament, of course, is equally strong in its condemnation of this, particularly Paul in Romans 1 talks about it being something against nature. Well, so we've got something that that morally, on the basis of a biblical acceptance of moral guidance, is morally reprehensible, and yet something for which one is not really responsible. And how can you hold somebody morally accountable for something for which he's not to be blamed? It happened to him, like blue eyes or blonde hair or whatever, not in a genetic sense, but it happened to him in a time when he was not able to make any choices about the matter. And how can you hold this person accountable and call him a sinner when in fact he couldn't help it? You can't blame, you can't hold people accountable for that which they cannot help doing. So it puts us in an interesting problem that's also enhanced by the fact that most Christian people who are compassionate and concerned are kind of on the side of oppressed people, people who don't get a fair shake of things. And of course the homosexual community does sometimes indicate that it is being deprived of some of its rights and so on. And Christian people don't like to have people have their rights, like to protect the person who is impoverished and denied full expression of himself. But you have that, plus the notion that this is a bad, sinful thing to do. And so you have a variety of responses to this, and as you know, in many circles, the attitudes toward homosexuality are shifting, and some churches are now having homosexual communities. I listened in a lecture in Berkeley 1 year to a pastor of a homosexual church in San Francisco, whose whole congregation were homosexuals, and he was a homosexual. He described how he became a homosexual. He was walking on a beach in Hawaii as a teenager. His father promised him a trip to Hawaii if he would get good grades. And so he got good grades and was sent there. And here he was. He got up early and was down on the beach before anybody else was on the beach and swimming in the surf. And finally he looked and observed there was an older male in his late teens out swimming in the surf. And they came together eventually. And he discovered, to his astonishment, that he became aroused by the presence of this fellow in his bathing suit. and they spent some time together, and he discovered at that point that he had interest in the same sex, and he learned to know what homosexuality was and discovered his homosexuality in that setting. He didn't choose to be homosexual, he just discovered
it.
Yeah. Well, he eventually decided to become an Anglican priest, and he was studying at a seminary in San Francisco to become an Anglican priest. But before he graduated, he kept quiet about his homosexual interests, and so he decided that it really wasn't right for him to do this, that he must go and talk to somebody about it. And so about a month or so before graduation, and in the Anglican communion, the graduation and ordination kind of go together, and so he was about to become a priest as well as becoming graduated, and so he went to his superior and confessed that he was a homosexual, and his superior went right through the roof. Kicked him out of school. He didn't graduate. He didn't become ordained until he became ordained later by a homosexual community.
Mm-hmm.
And now he was their pastor for all these years. But he had discovered his homosexuality rather than choosing it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said in his community there were people who had established long, enduring relationships. They just had a 25th year wedding anniversary of a homosexual couple that had lived together all those years in San Francisco. It was a stable, united setting, and nothing promiscuous about it, and whatever. Well, he was strongly advocating, of course, the privilege of doing this. Well, what should we as Christians require of people who have problems like that, for which they are not...
Or of ourselves in our relationship with them. That's the ethics all truth.
That's is correct. Well, I think, out of my understanding of God and his concern for us and his tolerance of our innate deviances and so on, that one has to accept the homosexual notion that in fact I am what I am and I cannot be something else. But we also have a right to insist that they behave in a responsible fashion. Now, what is a responsible fashion for a person of either sex? If you're a heterosexual, what do we expect from you as a responsible sexual behavior? It means that if you are living true to the kinds of principles that the scriptures contain with its prohibition of fornication and so on, that one has to contain oneself. Abstinence outside of marriage is at least an apparent biblical kind of notion. Well, many people seem to have forgotten that, but that is a tradition that has a long-standing background behind it.
And you are talking about Christian ethics at
this
point.
That's correct. And this is a Christian ethical principle. That sexuality outside of marriage is fornication and promiscuity. We insist on that, at least we used to insist on that, for people who are heterosexuals.
Would some secular ethicists agree with you on that?
I suspect there might be a few, but not many.
Not many. All right.
But what used to be living in sin has now become kind of having an experience with a significant other. But so that has changed generally in culture. But by and large, conservative Christians will still hold the notion that there's really something wrong with shacking up with people without making commitment and shacking around, sleeping around without committed ties. Well, I'm saying that if we have the right to expect Christian young people who are not married to refrain from promiscuous sexuality, we have the same right to insist that a person who's a homosexual.
Certainly comparable, isn't it?
They're comparable.
Yeah.
But the difference is that the homosexual has no legitimate outlet for his sexuality, at least his gonadal sexuality. Now, there are other kinds of sexual experience that are not to be confused with overt glandular gonadal sex. That is, there are people who can sublime their sexual drives into highly creative endeavors, art, music, literature, and do this very effectively and maintain a kind of life that is, while they're denied with certain kinds of physical experience, at the same time have fulfillment, and this releases some of their sexual libidinous drives in ways that are acceptable.
The public's become much more aware of this because of age lately, unfortunately.
That's right. So, what I'm saying is this, that on biblical grounds one has to say that what Paul is talking about, remember he later says, such were some of you, but by the grace of God you can overcome it. I think it is quite impossible for a person who is an exclusive homosexual to will to become a heterosexual or to be trained to become a heterosexual, whatever. Psychiatrists are by and large unanimous in their opinion that you can't really do anything about it as far as changing it. that the best that you can do is to help them to live with their problem and live creatively and responsibly with their problem. And I'd say that a person who does this is a person to be honored. And this person should have all of the rights in the church, all the openness and friendliness and whatever that becomes a part of Christian community on the basis of their living within the ranges of their limitations. So what I'm saying is that a consistent way of dealing with the biblical picture about homosexuality is that a person who is something he didn't choose to be recognizes his limitations that are imposed upon him because of this and lives within those limitations. And this would mean sexual continence and putting one's libidinous drives into other kinds of creative activity. And this should be carried out with the encouragement of Christians, whether heterosexual or homosexual. In other words, nothing should be denied these people that is not denied to heterosexual, except nature itself provides the denial by making it impossible for them to enjoy a heterosexual kind of experience.
Stories then of miraculous changes from homosexuality to heterosexuality.
This comes about because you have not just heterosexuality and homosexuality, you have a spectrum. Mm-hmm. At one end is the exclusive homosexual, and that's what I'm talking about largely. Mm-hmm. At the other end, the exclusive heterosexual. Mm-hmm. Then along the way, there's a kind of a transition where you have various levels of bisexuality. Mm-hmm.
You think those stories come out?
I think you're dealing with someone in the center. Mm-hmm. I had a patient come and see me once. It was a young lady who had three children, to tell me that her husband was a homosexual. Well, you would think he wouldn't be inclined to produce children if he was homosexual, mm-hmm. see. But he apparently was somebody who was a bisexual. Mm-hmm. And during her third pregnancy, during the latter part of the pregnancy, and they were not having sexual relationships because of her advanced pregnancy, but he went to a public restroom, and there he was accosted by an older homosexual and propositioned. Mm-hmm. And he found this attractive and got involved with him.
Didn't know before
that he was a homosexual. Mm-hmm. Got involved with this man, and finally, eventually, they became acquainted with each other, mm-hmm. and the older man asked him if he'd ever thought of getting married. The young man said, "Getting married? I am married. My wife is pregnant with our third child." "Oh," the older man, he said, "if we keep on doing what we're doing, you'll never be able to go back to your wife." Mm-hmm. It was already too late. He found her now repulsive. And the marriage was an end. Mm-hmm. Because he was a person who was somewhere in that inner period, and because he had grown up in an environment, he conformed to expected patterns of behavior and lived a moral life that his parents had taught him to live and so on, and just never really discovered why he really wasn't terribly interested in girls. And he married, and the girl he married said to me that it wasn't what my mother described, but it really was, you know, it wasn't all that bad, and I assumed that some marriages were like this.
The right and proper thing.
Yeah, the right thing. But now it was all gone.
Yeah.
Because in the process of this activity, what had been kind of held in abeyance because of his training and so on, he'd maintained a reasonably successful heterosexual marriage, because he'd now experimented, he flipped over and became what he basically was, which was mostly homosexual, see. But his training had, but he was still somewhere in the center. But the stories that you hear about people recovering or developing heterosexual behavior miraculously are stories that really reflect this kind of never land in between, where they're both sex. In fact, there are some people who are bisexuals who have sexual relationships with men and women concurrently. Mm-hmm. It's a shift back and forth. Well, so the family was a jeopardy. And I have several cases where families that I've known have, because of the homosexual behavior, were disintegrated. And that represents then part of what the rules were about. Mm-hmm. God gave certain kinds of rules to help us to maintain the relationships with each other that enable us to preserve and protect that nurturing environment which makes the self a possibility.
On that basis then, what should this husband, awaiting the arrival of the third child, ethically, what should he have done, having a concern for his wife and the children and the family unit?
He should have avoided becoming involved in a homosexual experience. Mm-hmm. And he should have practiced sexual continence as a way of avoiding that. Mm-hmm. In other words, that's what most men do. Most men don't find extracurricular sexual activities as a way of filling in those last weeks before their wives deliver. And this could, I think, appropriately be expected of him. Mm-hmm. Because he didn't do that, something that he wasn't aware of now slipped upon him, and he's now accountable. Interestingly enough, the homosexual community, some of whom wish to maintain strong Christian ties, mm-hmm. wish to reinterpret the scripture in favor of overt homosexual activity. Mm-hmm. The text in Romans 1, for example, where Paul talks of sins against nature, the homosexual may say, a Christian homosexual may say, but my nature is to be a homosexual. And it would be a violation of Paul's principle if I tried to be a heterosexual. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a kind of a twisting of notions and wresting of the scriptures in a way that seems to me to attempt to try to justify an action that is really quite morally unacceptable.
Well, if a man feels that he may be homosexual, should he tell this? I mean, ethically, should he tell the truth?
I think not.
Himself?
I think not, because you're not telling the truth gratuitously when mm-hmm. it is not a requirement seems to me to be really asking for trouble. I'm thinking of somebody that you would probably also know, but I shall not mention his name. A very brilliant young man, a fine philosophic mind, mm-hmm. theological mind, mm-hmm. who wanted to be a theologian, and went away to theological school and was preparing to be a minister, actually, with a really considerable amount of theological training. His classmates kept joking with him about his not being married, and mm-hmm. this got to him a little bit after a bit, and it came time to be thinking about taking a church, becoming a pastor, and the local conference president would come and visit the prospective ministers and ask them, among other things, are you married, and mm-hmm. let me meet your wife, and if you're not married, do you have intentions, can I meet your intended? Mm-hmm. Because being a pastor as a single man has a variety of problems connected with it. And so they did this with him, until finally he decided that he guessed he'd better get married. He never had any real interest in being married before this, but that he ought really to get married so that he can be a pastor. And so he did. It was a disaster. And he discovered at that point what mm-hmm. he had suspected. Mm-hmm. But others not thus discovered, because they had to have the marriage annulled. Mm-hmm. And in the annulment, it became obvious that he was a homosexual, and that he could not function as a heterosexual male. But this became public information then, mm-hmm. and ruined his career. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if this hadn't happened and they kept quiet, allowed this young man mm-hmm. to be what he was, that is, somebody who was containing himself and behaving respectably and responsibly mm-hmm. and putting his life into his career, and would have been a very successful career person. I see no reason why this person should not even have had access to the pulpit as a minister or as a theologian. Mm-hmm. If they just left him alone and allowed him to be what he was, and that is, a responsible person, mm-hmm. it would have been a quite different outcome.
That brings up the whole subject of telling the truth. Yes. Should you always tell the truth?
That is a question that I'm reminded of every Christmas time. We have as a tradition in our home the reading on Christmas Eve of the Other Wise Man.
Yeah, I love it.
Remember the story of the Other Wise Man, yeah. How he finds himself in this little house in Bethlehem, and the mother is looking after her child, and most of the inhabitants of the village are out in the fields or something. Mm-hmm. And the Roman soldiers are coming down the street with their dripping swords. Mm-hmm. Herod is ordering them to kill the children. And this other wise man steps to the door and greets the captain. Mm-hmm. Says, I have in my hand a ruby to give to the prudent captain who will leave us in peace. Mm-hmm. And the captain goes off down the street. Mm-hmm. And then this other wise man prays. He says, Dear God of truth, mm-hmm. he says, forgive my sin. I have told what is not for the sake of a little child. Mm-hmm. Now, is that right or wrong?
How about the organizations that try to smuggle, or do smuggle, Bibles across the Iron Curtain? How about that? And thank the Lord for success in doing it.
I had a student once that really raised a very interesting question. He was a Korean boy. Mm-hmm. And he sat in the front row of my ethics course. And we were talking about truth-telling. Mm-hmm. And he says, Professor, he says, I have something I want to tell you. He says, I was a little boy, 8 years old, when the North Koreans came across the line and invaded South Korea. And we lived not far from the borders of North Korea. Mm-hmm. He said, the soldiers came rushing into our town, the people all fled, but in our house we had housed 6 wounded Korean soldiers. He said, we had them hidden in the attic of the house. They couldn't travel with my parents when they left. My parents left me behind because I was a little boy. They thought maybe the enemy soldiers wouldn't do anything to me. So he said, I waited, and when they came, they said, is anybody here? He says, there's nobody here. Mm-hmm. You know, they went off down the street. Mm-hmm. The 6 soldiers were
about that now.
He told a lie, and it's what he asked me. He said, did I tell a lie when I did that?
Some good parallel stories in the Bible.
Oh yeah,
like that.
Those nice spies from Israel who were protected by somebody telling lies.
Yes, what about that?
Yes.
Interestingly, God makes no comment when Rahab lied about the 2 spies, or when the woman hid those 2 Israeli soldiers in her dry well. No comment. He didn't commend her either, he just, no comment.
Is there a time, well, if you get a choice between the commandments, for example, will you give some commandments priority over the others? For example, with the commandment not to bear false witness, if you don't bear false witness, somebody loses a life.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't you responsible for taking the life? Does thou shalt not kill take priority over thou shalt not bear false witness?
Mm-hmm.
You have here one of those situations in which you have competing claims and where your decision has to be a decision over which is the greater evil.
Is this like abortion? A choice between the fetus and the mother?
Correct. We've got dual claims and you have to decide which is the greater evil. Which is the lesser evil. If only all decisions came in blacks and whites, easy contrast, yes or no, it would be much more simple than the fact that they come in shades of gray. You have to decide which is the grayest. That isn't always easy to do. But you'd have to decide in the case of telling the truth as over against losing a life, and fortunately, most of the time, you don't have to make that kind of decision.
Mm-hmm.
A third way usually can come, and that is that one can withhold information.
Mm-hmm.
That may not be being straightforward, but at the same time, withholding information from people who have no right to that information may be a legitimate way to go.
Like protecting all the Jews fleeing from Nazi Germany?
That's correct.
Underground, many lives were spared.
That's right. But since selfhood of the individual whose life is being threatened is seriously threatened by what is coming, then one would have to say that if there were no other alternatives, that this would be the lesser of the two evils, which does not legitimate telling lies.
Mm-hmm.
It simply says that under this exception, it's the least wrong thing to do. And I would think that under those circumstances, if I were this little boy of 8, that this would be legitimate to say to him, when they come looking for these wounded men in our house, tell them nobody's here. I think this would be legitimate under those circumstances, if there were no other options.
What about the one who's telling the not the entire truth? Could it do any damage to that person if he's not able to have some way of rationalizing?
Well, I should think so. You know, we're dealing here with a basic principle of creation. That is, when God made us, he made us not to be alone, to be part of a community.
Mm-hmm.
The community is a part of God's intention in creation. You can't have community, as I suggested the other night. You can't have community unless you have trust. And trust usually depends upon whether or not you tell the truth. And if you don't tell the truth, then you break down trust, whether it's in a family or in a larger society, a nation. Presidents who don't tell the truth undermine confidence, whether they are presidents of the nation or of a church or a school or whatever. And certainly this is true of the intimate society called a family. And once in a while, my medical students ask me to perform weddings for them. Out of my concern for the durability of their marriage and the sanctity of their union, I've now developed a set of vows that I have them say with me. Now they can decorate it up however they please, but somewhere along the line, I want them to say to each other in my presence, the presence of this company, I want them to say, I will never lie to you, as one of the promises. Not only in sickness and health and all the rest, but I also will always tell you the truth. I'll never lie to you. I'm convinced that if all young people, when they married and established their families, could say that and mean it, that most of the things that result from broken communications, broken sense of closeness, broken trust, would dissipate and marriages would endure. People who tell the truth to each other, stay together. just as people who pray together stay together, people who tell the truth to each other also stay together. But another is interesting question, how much truth?
That's it.
What if somebody in his youth, before he married, lived a life that was profligate, he was promiscuous and so on. Should he tell his prospective bride all the stories about the past? Or worse, I once had another lady come to me with a consultation who was pregnant and was seeking information about an abortion. And I asked about what had happened, and it so happened that she had become sexually involved with a man of another race. Her husband had had a vasectomy, and she had gotten pregnant after he had the vasectomy. And it was a pregnancy that would give a color to the skin of the child when it was born.
So she
couldn't hide it. And now she wanted to know, because this would wreck her marriage. She already had a couple of children. This would wreck her marriage, so that in fact the children would be deprived of two parents and the home and all the things that can happen in divorce. And she wanted to know whether she should get an abortion. She couldn't lie to her husband in this case. You see. Now, what if, on the other hand, they say she wasn't pregnant, but just had an affair? Should she tell her husband? Well, now that's a very interesting problem, because this can sometimes be a shattering thing, depending upon the maturity and the ability of an individual to accept a revelation like that. Generally, one has to say, however, that the security of that marriage depends so much on trust that there's some things you're obligated to say. Now, whether or not you have to go back and drag up everything back in a time when, in fact, you hadn't made commitments to this individual, I think not. I think that one might have to say something simply like, look, I haven't always been a Christian, a moral person, and leave it at that. But once you've made those commitments, it seems to me that you have violated something very sacred in that relationship, and that whether or not you can stave off the fateful day, that retaining that lie, maintaining it, is bound sooner or later to do something to your relationship. And what you better do, generally, as a general rule, what you'd better do is get it off your chest. Even though this might be hazardous and dangerous and hard to do, you still, for the sake of the future, because sooner or later, the keeping of that secret is likely to produce a distance between you that's going to jeopardize your relation. Now, this may seem a little rigid, but I'm convinced that honesty is so important a part of human behavior, maintaining much of what selfhood is all about. And when I define selfhood, if you remember, it had to do with the capacity of individuals to interrelate with each other, to be able to communicate with each other and to love each other. And this jeopardizes the fact of oneself at the social level, and thus jeopardizes that institutional barrier that nurtures and protects selfhood. And is, I think, a very important kind of truth to pass on to our children.
Apply that to the rationalizing of a president who might reason that to preserve the confidence of the nation in the presidency, it would be best to keep something suppressed and even erased.
Like Eisenhower lying about the overflights of the...
Unfortunately, we can think of several, so we don't have to pick up only one. Would that be a legitimate concern? Or is he undermining... potentially the trust that is essential for...
From earliest days, back in the early Middle Ages, the ruling was regarding telling the truth, that there were three exceptions, three times which you could tell lies justly and without sin. One of these had to do in a military situation, where, you know, if you tell more than your name, rank, and serial number... you are then jeopardizing your troops. Well, do you have a right to lie in those circumstances? The other one had to do with self-defense. If your life was at stake, maybe the late fathers actually involved in this, they taught that if your life is jeopardized, then you may lie to save your life. And the third one is one of some interest, that is, you may lie for God's honor. And this becomes the legitimation of all those bogus relics, those false decretals, and all those things that over the centuries have characterized certain aspects of Christian worship. They say there are enough pieces of the cross that were brought back from the Crusades to make many crosses.
Yeah.
And somebody said it's like the loaves and fishes, the crosses and multiplies.
And the nails have too.
Yes. And I was in the church at Peter's Chains in Rome. You may mm-hmm. have been there and seen Pilate's staircase that they still go up on their knees. And I'd just been in Pilate's courtyard in Jerusalem just a mm-hmm. short time ago. You'd never get that staircase in Pilate's courtyard. It's mm-hmm. much too big for it.
Yeah.
And you know all the bogus things that yeah. are all over the world in the various reliquaries and mm-hmm. churches, shrines. Well, this is mm-hmm. justification for this. And it is also the justification for the statement that you need not keep faith with heretics. You can lie to mm-hmm. heretics because that's for God's honor.
But could you serve as a spy for the United States?
No. There are some occupations you cannot get into as a Christian without placing yourself in a situation of jeopardy, morally. Mm-hmm. You couldn't do it. In one of Joseph Fletcher's books, yeah. he describes an interesting account. You may have seen this. Where this woman was invited by the CIA to become a spy mm-hmm. during wartime. And part of the requirement was that she go and get involved with one of the enemy diplomats, yeah. sexually involved with yeah. him, and then kind of wheel out of him some secrets that she could send back to America as a part of her intelligence gathering. She said, "I don't do a thing like that." Well, they said, "Look, you're expecting your father and your brothers to risk their lives in the mm-hmm. battlefield. You mean you wouldn't be willing to risk your body for your country?"
Mm-hmm.
Well, Joseph Fletcher, that's as far as you went with the story. He left it as an open-ended mm-hmm. thing, as a question. But in telling the story personally to me, he told me the rest of the story. He said he was riding on a train one day, and there was two seats vacant. He sat down one of them, and he was trying to get a book read that he just purchased, and mm-hmm. it was very interesting to him. And he had his white claret collar on, and he was reading this book, and somebody came over and sat down next to him, and she kept nudging him and looking at him and pushing him, trying to get his attention. And finally he turned to her and she says, "You're a clergyman, aren't you?" He said, "Yes." And so she said, "Are you from around here?" And he finally introduced himself to her. Joseph Fletcher, she had read mm-hmm. one of his books and knew he was a situationist.
Mm-hmm.
"Oh," she says, "I want to ask you a question." She says, "I've got a real problem. I've been invited by the CIA to become a spy
mm-hmm.
and to get one of the diplomats on the enemy involved in a way that I can then extract some secrets from him
mm-hmm.
for the sake of my country." She said, "It would be morally right for me to do it." He said, "If I were you, I wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's right." Well, she said, "That's strange." She said, "You're a situationist, mm-hmm. and I should expect you to say something else. Why would you say this?"
Mm-hmm.
He says, "Because if you can sit down next to me as a perfect stranger mm-hmm. and tell me all these plans of the CIA, you aren't up to it."
Oh, anyway. How about using violence to protect your family?
Oh, yes.
Taking one life to save another.
That's another interesting area.
Yeah.
Anyway,
and all too often a real problem people face.
Let me summarize first by truth-telling mm-hmm. concept. The truth is so important. So important mm-hmm. a part of human interrelationships mm-hmm. that you have to have something else that is much greater mm-hmm. in jeopardy mm-hmm. before you dare tamper with it.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, there's a third way of escape, even if it includes only keeping your mouth shut, letting them think what they may.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Might you, though, say something reassuring to a dying patient that means one thing to you and another to the patient?
Oh, yes. You're not responsible for how people perceive what you've said.
Mm-hmm.
You're only responsible for what you intend to be saying.
I'm thinking, say, it's your own child is dying, and you're saying, "It's all right. Everything's going to be all right." You know in the resurrection, you're going to see your child again. It's going to be all right. The little child thinks, "I'm going to wake up healthy in the morning."
But unfortunately,
you haven't done any damage, have you, to anybody?
But unfortunately, I may have done some damage to myself, because I know that I'm yeah. twisting the truth.
Yeah.
And I know what kind of an impression I'm intending to communicate to
mm-hmm.
them, even though the words may be right.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose some of the worst lies are lies that have the right words, but mm-hmm. the wrong intention.
Mm-hmm.
You can lie with the truth sometimes mm-hmm. by misapplying it and twisting it so that it fulfills a distorted...
So you even have to consider how the other person will read meaning into these symbols that you're
correct.
Using.
And you should try then to communicate as best you can. But even God, in dealing with us, faces a language problem, as
yeah, yeah.
we all do. And God, I think sometimes after he gets through speaking, says, "I mean, that's the best I can do. I know I haven't told the truth, but many things I would say to you, but you can't bear them
yeah.
yet."
Yeah.
because it's just important.
Knowing they'd come to a wrong conclusion.
That's correct, knowing that.
At the time.
Allowing that wrong conclusion to come,
yes.
But rectifying it eventually, yes. So that it's the best thing you can do at the moment. Sometimes you have to wait for the full truth to come.
Does it result in a great concern for the other person?
Yes. In other words, the intention, you see, is not to deceive,
yes.
But to try to help and try to heal and try to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes in doing that, you'd have to communicate in a way that would be not appropriate for you, but will be appropriate for that one person.
Mm-hmm.
But to do it always with the intention, but secure and to help and to nurture rather than to deceive and take advantage of. Well, back to your other question. The scriptures describe for us, from Jesus' standpoint, a rejection of violent response in face of threat.
Yeah.
And, you know, turning the other cheek,
yes.
And he that takes up the sword shall perish with the sword, and so on. What do you do if the one who threatens you doesn't understand that language?
Mm-hmm.
You don't turn your other cheek to a madman.
Mm-hmm.
Because the message, which is a very powerful message, what Jesus is giving is, as Gandhi knew and Martin Luther King knew, that nonviolence is a very potent kind of weapon.
Mm-hmm.
The British lost India because of somebody practicing nonviolence in his opposition to British rule. It's a very powerful weapon. But it only works on a people or a person who is sensitive to that kind of lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And a madman who may not be sensitive. You know, one of my classmates earned a little money to help him through medical school by acting as a special nurse in a psychiatric case.
Mm-hmm.
And this patient that he was staying with hour after hour seemed perfectly innocuous. He was a friendly kind of fellow, you know, and peaceful and so on. And he momentarily turned his face and looked at something else, and the man suddenly turned on him and smashed him in the face and broke his eyeglasses and drove glass into his eye and he lost an eye.
Mm-hmm.
He turned his back on a madman and you're in trouble. See? Well, I think that something like that applies because it is the case that there is a kind of moral madness in which persons who may be behaving compulsively. You may not always know whether or not this person is morally mad. And I say, if you had the opportunity, if I were, for example, a woman about to be raped by somebody who's a sexual lunatic who's attacking me, it might be legitimate, before you shot him, or hit him over the head with a ball bat or whatever, it might be legitimate to try to see if he wouldn't be sensitive to one's entreaties. Somebody breaking into my house, you know, rather than being prepared to ball bat him or to shoot him as he broke into the house, it might be appropriate, if you had time and the occasion, to try to manifest a kind of protection even for his madness so that you could talk him out of it and help him to get some sort of reason. But if that doesn't work and you don't have time to do it, my feeling is that a Christian has the right not to kill, not to intend to harm, but rather to restrain.
Mm-hmm.
And there are various ways of restraining evil, including restraining for the sake of the evil person.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that the use of even a force as a restraining technique, which would mean that if somebody broke into my house and I were armed, and I know how to use a gun, by the way, if I had proper equipment, and this were the only kind of way I had to restrain him, I would try to in some way injure him so that he couldn't do what he intended to do. First I'd try to talk him out of it. And if he was slipping into my bedroom at night and going through the drawers of my closet, I wouldn't risk getting involved defensively over what I have in my drawers of my bureau. I mean, he can have that. See, but if he starts from my daughter's bedroom or my wife's side of the bed, at that point I have certain kinds of obligations, and he that does not look after his family is worse than an infidel. And that means looking after protectively, but with the intention of restraining and not with the intention of doing harm.
Should one then be equipped to take such defensive action?
One should be equipped in a variety of ways, preferably those that are really effective. If you haven't got the effective means, and I'm saying the best equipment is to have good locks on your doors and windows and practice ordinary self-protective techniques. But given the society that we now live in, the insecurity of parking lots and so on, increasingly it seems to me that Christians may have to be prepared to defend their loved ones. But in doing so, it seems to me that one has to practice, even before the event, the Spirit of Christ in one's life that enables one to do the right thing for the right reasons at that time. Mm-hmm. And that is what one does to restrain the evil rather than to either punish it or to in some way destroy the evil person out of an enmity and hostility.
Be right to agonize afterwards over having to take such an action?
I suppose one might say that it's right in the sense that it's probably important not to feel good about having to do something.
I did the ethical thing, so it doesn't bother me.
No, you probably should be barred.
Would that be true even with abortion?
I'd say that even with abortion, a person who performs an abortion for the right reasons mm-hmm. ought not to enjoy it. Mm. It ought to be unpleasant and it should be painful.
And always be re-examining.
To be sure that you are doing the right thing. Because mm-hmm. if it ever becomes too easy for us, then you see mm-hmm. we may have already blunted our sensitivities, that then these sensitivities that could protect us mm-hmm. from the kind of behavior.
How about deceiving customs to get Bibles in? Could that spill over into getting other things through customs dishonestly?
Well, I suppose that's
become a habit.
Properly so on.
So this suggests all along a sensitive, intelligent individual. Who cares about
who may not have easy ready-made rules to guide him
yeah.
who may have to make decisions, but decisions hopefully based upon the development of a character so mm-hmm. that one can draw on the resources of the kind of person you are so that mm-hmm. your decisions are more likely to be the right ones even in a desperate and very sudden set of circumstances.
And in view of the grayness of some of these decisions, how could you live with yourself if you had to make these decisions very frequently and be at peace with yourself?
I should think that the grays would get a little murky if one had to do this too often, but still one has to be prepared to face life in those levels, and that's why I say yeah. at the outset I talked about the difference between morality and ethics.
Yeah.
Ethics has to be prepared to move appropriately. And I'm reminded of something else that I ran into in a little hospital once. Two surgeons were scrubbing together. Now, that's a fairly ritualistic kind of thing, and mm-hmm. not, I think, practiced with the kind of care that one is taught to practice with sometimes. Mm-hmm. But these two surgeons were scrubbing very religiously and so many times here and there and using the right techniques and the right amount of time. Mm-hmm. In those days they didn't have nearly as effective germicidal mm-hmm. preparations as we now have, but you could tell the difference between a person who was truly ethical mm-hmm. and a person who was merely legally moral.
Mm-hmm.
By what they both did after they had finished their surgery and now had contaminated themselves and were starting for home. They walked past the emergency room, side by side, and inside the emergency room, somebody was bleeding to death. And all the nurses were yelling for somebody to come and help. And the one surgeon said, "Wait, I'll scrub." And the other went and stuck his dirty hand in the wound and she fell off the bleeder. Contaminated the wound in the process, mm-hmm. but was prepared to make an adjustment of his moral training, his surgical training, and make an adjustment to meet the emergency.
He'd risk his reputation a little bit.
He might even.
Even malpractice.
He might very well produce infection.
He cared enough to run a risk.
He ran the risk because he cared enough, and he was willing to modify his behavior because of the needs of the moment. And that seems to me to be an appropriate kind of situation ethics based upon principles that are enduring. Mm-hmm. That is, I must save this life. That's more important than my following the rules. For it is the case. The rules mm-hmm. are God's ways of guiding us to self-fulfillment mm-hmm. and to the fulfillment of other selves. One will never be able to fulfill oneself if one does not be sensitive to the assistance that God has given us by giving us the rules. And that's what ethics is all about. That's the end of the story.
That's a good ending. That's a good summary. Yeah. Good summary. I was tempted to ask you, since you talked about Christian ethics, does it help to be a Christian in making these decisions, but does it depend what kind of Christian you are?
Yeah, you put Christian mean by this,
yeah.
follower of Christ,
yeah.
rather than a member of a Christian church someplace.
Yeah.
It's a serious notion, it surely does, because it yeah. gives you the proper kinds of motivation and caring mm-hmm. that enables you to even suspend the rigid application of the rules mm-hmm. for a good purpose.
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with Fletcher's situationism mm-hmm. is that he isn't talking about those eternal principles that make it...
Those aren't a new situation.
Right. yeah. All you have to do with them is the emergency room mm-hmm. rather than the eternal mm-hmm. principles that have to do with caring. And him.
Because his theory was right. If he could include those things in his situation.
It just it wasn't inclusive enough.
Yeah. That's why you had to change it to responsible ethics instead of situation ethics.
Well, he wrote a book, Responsible Ethics.
Oh, he did that? Yeah,
his second book was Responsible Ethics.
Oh, yeah, I didn't realize he
did. You have functioned in the underground in World War II?
Yes, I think so. And it would be those would be places where the shades of gray where I'd have to suspend my ordinary kind of behavior for good reasons.
Mm-hmm. You know, it was very interesting to me. It just so happened in my personal experience, I read two books about World War II within a short period of time of each other. The first book I read was the one by Ford on Free the Captor with his all the details of his underground and and falsifying documents and all this kind of stuff. And a short time later, I read this one, The Seventh Escape. The guy who gets taken away behind the Russian lines and he's seven times in prison. And he had a code with God, he felt, that he would not tell a lie. If they would say to him, are you an escaping prisoner? He would say, yes, I am. And they'd throw him in prison. But he had the impression that, I mean, it was his compact with God that he, if he told the truth, God would take care of him.
Yeah.
And he wrote that book with the implied idea that when he told the truth, God would find a way for him to get out of the next prison, and off he'd go again.
Mm-hmm.
And someone say, "Are you an escaping prisoner?" Yeah, back into prison, to another prison. Then God would get him out again, which is interesting.
Ford is dealing with other people.
I was going to just say, one's with me and one's with somebody else.
It's one thing for me to risk my life, and this is also true in self-defense. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to protect my children. Mm-hmm. It's another thing to use violence to protect myself.
But you see, at least maybe I didn't understand it correctly, but my understanding of his principle, the guy escaping from all those prisons, I think he would have said to Ford, well, if you told the truth, God would find some other way to hide your prisoners.
Just like he did for Rahab.
Yeah.
Carry that too far, the burglar coming through the window, and he's just broken the glass. You say, careful, you'll cut yourself. Let me show you where the door is. God will take care of it.
Invite him into supper.
Oh, look, Jack is an ethical man. There's my dollar. That should have shown on video. Hey, that could have ended that way. By the way, here's your dollar. That would have been a good ending.
Well, yeah, it's on.
Oh, it did? It should have multiplied in your hands. Oh, dear.
Well, what is the stand of abortion in relation to measles in the first trimester?
Oh, yeah.
That's a very difficult one because you're now dealing with the percentages. And I'm willing to admit that my opinion would not be something that somebody else could feel very confident in. But I think if you had, say, 99% of the offspring are going to have this defect, then that might be a legitimation. Mm-hmm. But you say maybe 20 or 50%, will you destroy 50 or 80% normal fetuses while you're getting at these abnormal ones?
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that you, unless you can detect this as actually having occurred, that you have to wait until you know. And it's just like with the Down syndrome.
I don't know what the statistics are now, and I've lost track of it because
it depends.
25%.
It depends. It depends upon when, too. Doesn't it? Which
but measles month? Is a big problem now.
Oh, well, sure it is. Sure.
Yeah. Day. People are not being immunized for it anymore. Properly. And
there's some cases around here, quite a few.
So I just wonder what obstetricians are doing these days. Do you know, Ken?
No.
But they just routinely abort in the presence of, say, 20% of possibility. Mm-hmm. That, in my mind, is I worry about that 80% that's the normal that you're destroying.
See, the difficulty in that particular case is that you can detect some of those defects, but not until it's too late for you to legitimately or legally abort.
Mm-hmm. Now that becomes a problem. But if the percentages are very, very high, you can almost say that 100% of these are going to get trouble. And it's a kind of trouble that inhibits their functioning as persons. Then I'd be inclined.
You could almost bend Abraham's story there, where he says, Lord, if there were 50, would you destroy them all? 40, 30, 10, 5, you wouldn't. So you're saying if only 50% could be.
But that is a tough one.
Yeah.
And in a case like the Down syndrome, where you don't really know how defective this is going, mentally defective this is going to be until, you know, months or years after birth,
yeah.
That's even kind of tougher. Some of them are pretty good and some of them are very bad.
We used to face that with breast cancer too, if they got pregnant and had breast cancer, should they be aborted? Should the patient be aborted? That's an easy answer now because there's been enough statistics that it doesn't help to abort.
Uh-huh.
So you can go ahead and encourage the patient that they can go ahead and have the pregnancy. So it becomes easier for us.
But there's no rule that I know of that can answer all the questions. And all you can hope to do is, by a little preparatory ethical thinking, develop some general principles that can guide you at least, so you don't just hit the thing cold without any kind of pattern within which to make up your mind. But you're still going to have to wrestle. As long as the person is doing so honestly and doing the best he can, you know, I think this is all that God expects of us, is to live within our limits.
When I was a medical student, I think the only abortion I saw in this medical center was an interesting case, and I wonder what you would say about it. Young girl, I suppose she was 17 or 18, and she had gotten pregnant by mistake. She obviously wasn't married and so forth. But the thing that made the legitimizing factor, at least in the eyes of her physician, was that not long before that, her father had died of familial polyposis. It's an autosomal dominant. She had it, and any child she had would have it, and therefore a relatively high risk of developing colon cancer. But with the facilities, I mean, the means we have now of shortening, either cutting out a portion of the bowel and leaving just enough so that we can do sigmoidoscopy on a regular basis and so forth, you could presumably, I mean, they are now preserving the lives of these people. But this girl came and convinced this physician that because there was no way at that point that she could legitimately, I mean, this baby could guarantee to be born free of cancer, but he was going to have this condition, that he should be aborted.
What's the percentages of possibility on this?
Well, that's 100%.
100%, yeah.
But you see, not 100% of them are going to die of cancer. 100% of them will get cancer. 100% of them will get polyps. And if you do nothing, 100% of those polyps, or in a long enough period of time, some of those polyps will turn to cancer. But what they do, and Ralph probably knows what maybe there's even some newer treatments, but at that point in time, what you did was take out most of the large bowel, which is the part affected. Leave them with a piece of large bowel about that long that you could easily look at with a sigmoidoscope. And you just have to be sigmoidoscoped on a regular basis, and anything that starts to develop, you nip it out of there. And you could, you know, if you were very faithful in doing this, you could presumably protect them against developing overt cancer.
Yeah. Well, with the treatment that's now available, one would probably say no abortion. But if you had 100% of these that were going to become cancerous, and the child wouldn't have long enough life, perhaps to... How long would they live?
Well, I think I would say no, because most of them don't develop polyps till they're teenagers.
That's right. I see. So you get
they
some...
They don't develop cancer till they're 35.
Well, I'd say no then on that basis, yes.
You see, that's right.
It's a little like Huntington's chorea. In which the individual may be 40 years old or so before he gets the symptoms of this. And would you abort a child and deny it the 40 years of meaningful life just because of the ending? I'd say no.
And then you have techniques too that can take the mucosa, clear out of the rectum, and still save sphincter function.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's what they do in ulcerative colitis now. So I think that it wouldn't be a good reason.
No, I think you're right.
But at that point, it was considered
a reason.
Well, I think that the compelling reason was that she wanted an abortion, and this was used probably as a legitimizing excuse at the point, but that was the story.
Well, I think even in our own medical center, we may have been a little more liberal 10 years ago or more, but I think it's much more conservative now.
Hmm. Is that true about abortions in general?
In our medical side,
I thought when
there was a period of time when there were a few more done. Uh-huh.
Zipric?
Yeah, when Zipric was here, he was pretty conservative on it.
Pardon me?
Zipric was pretty conservative on it.
Yes, that's true. But some of the men, I don't know all the details of how they decided, but I know there were men in the department that were a little more liberal. Uh-huh.
But now in the psychic reduction model, why do they care? The little spirits are going to go straight to bliss if they make a mistake. Same way with capital punishment. What a great way to put the problem in the Lord's hands. If the earthly court has made a mistake, the spirit will go to heaven, and if the person is really deserving, he'll be sent to that other place. So this fails safe, isn't it?
It goes to show that our practice and our theology is not always consistent.
No, it isn't consistent at
well,
all.
if the average person on the street, and particularly the average pastor, were made to think through his theology and make it mm-hmm. consistent, mm-hmm. what a different world we would have.
Do very many ethicists actually believe abortion is all right for birth control?
I don't know of any that hold that position.
They haven't been to Thailand and Red China and places like
that. Well, they'll practically all admit that there may be circumstances where it's not possible to practice birth control without at least some use of abortion. Mm-hmm. But that's on the basis of protecting against overpopulation, starvation, and so on as a result. So you're doing something that they consider to be inherently wrong, but not as wrong as having too many people around in certain cultures. But mm-hmm. to say that abortion is a legitimate way, in fact, most of them will object to this newer technique that some women are using, you know, with using the suction method earlier to suck out menses and take out of whatever pregnancy has to be there at the same time, and do this on themselves. They've got some clubs going on which they do this regularly. Mm-hmm. And most obstetricians find that horrendous as a way of contraception, but also somewhat of a violation of their professional interests.
How about our Adventist women in China with the restriction there? Are they required to have abortions? If there's more than one child?
I assume all Chinese women are required to have just one child without punishment.
Now what if the wife has reason for believing this is a very wrong thing to do?
And she has to pay the penalty, I guess.
You know about the couple that was here in the U.S.?
From China?
Yeah, from China.
Yeah.
And the wife got pregnant the second time. Mm-hmm. And they sent word to the embassy, you will have an abortion. Mm-hmm. And she refused. And there was an international incident for it.
I heard of that.
That wasn't too long ago.
No. Well,
what's the right thing to do in a case like that?
The other side, if you'll allow me a little humor, there's a fellow here on the... I don't know if he's on the staff here, whether he's a resident or a student or whatever, who's from Indonesia. And he has three children. And he was discussing with his wife about whether they should have any more children. And his wife was sort of favoring, an additional child. And he said, no way. And she says, why not? He said, world statistics show that every fourth child is born in Chinese, and I don't have a Chinese in my family.
How's that? that's rather good, isn't it? So, that's using statistics.
I heard about the fellow who was afraid of flying because of bombers being on planes, terrorists doing this. So he went down to the ticket counter and he asked the fellow, what are the chances of there being a bomb on this plane? And the fellow said, oh, about a million to one that there'd be one. He said, what are the chances there'd be two bombs on the plane? Oh, he said, that'd be about 10 billion to one. Okay, he said, and so he flew. He said, how come you did this? I thought you were afraid. Mm-hmm. Oh, he said, I carried on a bomb myself and I figured the chances were so improved that...
There we go again. By statistics, you can do anything with statistics, can't you? Oh dear. That's rather good. Do you remember in the early days when they began examining things being carried on after the first bomb scares, Elder Hartin, you remember his humor?
Yes.
And he had been, had he been in the Far East, and he was given a model of the Taj Mahal in little box, he was bringing it home, a beautiful little thing. And you were not supposed to joke about this as you went through security. And so here he came up carrying this little package, and they said, "What's in the package?" He said, "The Taj Mahal." And he really got into difficulty. But they opened it up, and there he was. Can you imagine? During the war, Ernie Lutz and I were canvassing in Arizona. And when we came back into California, and this was in 1941, when they were checking at the borders, and they came to the window of my little old, what year was that thing? Real old Chevrolet. And they said, "Where were you boys born?" "London, England, and Shanghai, China." Boy, did they pull us over and give us the works. "You sassy little rascal." And we didn't have our passports with it. It's a long time before we calmed them down. Because they were taken very seriously those days. Don't make humor over this. London, England, and Shanghai, China.
My mother-in-law does a little slightly unethical thing quite regularly. She was born in Mussoorie, India. Missionary parents, obviously. Yes. And when she crosses borders in this country, you know, Canada and down into Mexico and so forth, and they ask her there, "Well, I was born in Missouri." And
she was.
Yeah, she was.
Now there's a case of them reading the wrong thing. They're not supposed to do that.
They tell a tale of the Second World War of one of the underground, a lady, when the SS troops came to the place, and there was a table that had been placed over a trap door into the basement, and she had some of the underground hidden in that underneath that trap door in the basement. They had the table over the top of the trap door. They came and asked where these people were, and she said, "Under the table."
They looked.
Look at the smart with us.
That's the truth. That's the truth. Where's the damage done in that?
The damage would be done in not finding some way to keep the SS people from fighting those people.
Yeah.
See, some people have no right to that information.
Mm-hmm.
You must deny it to them because of the malevolent intention that is involved in their actions.
Mm-hmm. I think an Adventist ought to have a gun and know how to use it.
Well, there are some places where one should.
Some places, yeah. Best not to have it if you don't know how to use it,
That's right.
I understand the police will say, if you had a gun, would you use it? If not, you'd better not to have it.
Mm-hmm. Not only that, it's no use. I mean, people, you know, I've been to seminars where they discuss this and so forth, because this is one of the things we struggle with. You know, I work in a place where people sometimes have to use them.
Mm-hmm.
And they would just tell you, if you're serious about having a gun and think you might have to use it, you've got to have it within arm's reach of where you sleep, and it has to be loaded all the time. In other words, in order for you to get at it fast enough and be able to use it to be effective, it's got to be, I mean, and the question is, particularly for people who have children and so forth, you know, is it safe?
I'll never forget on President's Committee when we finally had a School of Health, and Mervyn Harding was the first dean, and so he was added to the President's Committee. And shortly thereafter, you know, his house used to be on the hillside, he caught a fellow rummaging around his place. And he got his shotgun out, and as the fellow fled through the trees, he shot and he peppered him. And he came to President's Committee and told us. And you should have seen all the looks around the table. Because you know what a saint Mervyn is. That the saint had been the one. They said if anyone else around the table had done it, it might be different. But the Mervyn would do it, and he got him. He hit him. And Mervyn told us with some satisfaction how the fellow ran for his life. And he did not expect him back.
Well, I'd have probably shot across his bow.
Across his bow. I think that's where he did hit him.
He had rock salt in it.
Bow or stern. Rock salt, yes.
You heard the story about the old Quaker with his gun, and he said, friend, I would do thee no harm for the world, but I'm about to shoot where thou art standing.
Where thou art standing. Oh, that's rather good. That's something. Jack, if you were to prepare a presentation on ethics for Eastern Europe, for Russia, would you say anything different with their cultures?
I'd have to know more about their cultures before I'd respond to that.
Yeah.
I'd have to go to Russia for a while and
yeah.
get a feeling for it. Just as even though I taught that course in Islamic ethics
yes.
and hadn't been there very long, I was there long enough to read mm-hmm. enough and to sense the mood mm-hmm. of the place to get a little feeling for mm-hmm. what the Quran said. And mm-hmm. I think it's probably not well advised to start pontificating mm-hmm. from a position of ignorance on some of these things.
But now what you've been saying and illustrating here these few times, in how many countries and how many cultures would this be understood? And the examples be appropriate?
I think if one could put it in the language and the thought forms and the experiences of the yeah. place, most of these things are mm-hmm. are at least, well, say, European, American.
Yeah.
Maybe some parts of the third world might have yes. a problem, maybe some of the Far East, but by and large, these are human problems.
Would South America be at all different?
Certainly not parts
no.
of it wouldn't be.
No? So it's only a limited area. Well, this would be different. Would China be very different?
I can't tell you that much about China. But, you know, China's been involved with the West for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect there are some parts of China that mm-hmm. haven't been westernized very much.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what the differences would be and what different illustrations and examples That's, you'd use.
It would be interesting
for them
to find out.
From what Joan said the other night, it sounded like the Russians needed some ethics courses on lying.
Yes, Leningrad there.
They just, it's the way of life, she said.
Yeah.
They just lie about everything.
Yeah.
That's physicians and uh-huh. in the hospitals in Leningrad.
Yeah. That was
very
extraordinary.
Very misleading to her.
Huh? So both she and the General Commons had to back out of what they were planning for Leningrad. She said Neil Wilson had run into the very same thing. But she found they were more trustworthy in Moscow. It seemed a little unusual.
That's so.
Yeah. Hmm.
Do we have a report on the church in Leningrad?
The money that went?
The money that went.
Sorry. Yes. Wasn't there something said about that?
Well, you mean from the university?
Yes. It was used, wasn't it?
I think it arrived, yeah.
Didn't they use it?
Used it, but I don't know any more.
I thought we had a report on that.
Tom Zirkle, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Did you see Tom's pictures of Russia
no.
on one of your trips? That's tremendous, isn't it?
Oh, we should
absolutely.
Have Tom come over and
say, wouldn't Jack love that?
Tom Zirkle?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, he showed him at our house.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
That was one great evening.
Report really? On the seminary?
Pictures of it. Yeah. You would that really would like that.
Yes.
So.
It was a thrilling story, wasn't it?
Oh, it was a marvelous story.
Yeah.
Which included the procession from Moscow out to the seminary. And the limousines and Neil is a VIP at all times.
He loves that, doesn't he?
You know, yeah. So, and as they went out, all the stoplights were green,
uh-huh.
and even buses approaching had to go off to the side, even off the road.
Right.
So afterwards, I asked Tom how Neil managed to adjust himself to this. He said, very readily. he thought he carried that very well. But the whole story and the description of that visit to Russia was really worth seeing.
What I found fascinating was the fact that when they asked the government if they could have a place to have a seminary, do you know the story?
No.
It's a great story.
They
yeah.
said, sure, you can have this one right here, this building out. It's sort of out in the...
It was with him.
Well, just, you knew about it. I don't know.
What's the outcome?
What happened? Mitt Leiter has been over in Russia also, and he's going around. And-